one thing that I've always been willing to do is to work for free. Because when you work for free, you learn the most, because you realize that you have to find a way to get your ROI in the end somewhere else. Because if you're working for pay, oftentimes you just collect paychecks.
We're on a mission. We're going to find and uncover the smartest, most successful entrepreneurs on the planet, explore their highs, their lows, and how they ultimately mastered the game. I'm Martin Cook, and I'm excited to welcome you to the Smarter Destiny podcast. I'm grateful for you and your time. Now let's level up together. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another Smarter Destiny podcast. So this time we're joined by my friend Quinn Hobbs. He is the founder and winemaker at hollowwines.com, a seven-figure ethical wine brand producing fantastic wines as they're supposed to be, as free from additives as humanly possible, whilst ethically employing people, sustainably farming the grapes, and generally educating the world about why we need to change and why we can produce amazing things without creating a terribly incredible, terribly bad impact on the planet. Hollow Wines is out to change all of that with their fantastic tasting wines. And if that isn't enough, in his spare time, I say with a sort of air quotes, in his spare time, Quinn is also doing a PhD in the Global Leadership and Change Program to even further his education about how to change the world for the better, so that he can really drive that movement from his area and make a global impact with everything he touches. I'm excited about this one. Quinn is absolutely an enlightened entrepreneur. Hollow Wines is an incredible brand, and I am excited to learn more about it, where it came from, and everything else that this show, this wonderful episode, is going to bring up. So without further ado, let's welcome him to the stage. Quinn, how's it going?
Doing great, man.
Nice. Whereabouts in the world? Whereabouts in the world are you, Quinn?
I am most time in California. I say that because I unfortunately have to travel between my vineyards and my production facility and where I live. But I'm based in Los Angeles. Hollow Wines is a Central Coast operation, so you know we're a little bit further north, about 4 hours drive north of here. So that's where we produce wine.
Amazing. And I think in this episode, we're definitely going to get into a little bit about making wine, because I've seen some great photos of you up to your ankles in barrels full of grapes, treading them, crushing them with your feet. And I've seen other giant distilleries and stuff. Been fairly stalking your social presence, actually, Quinn, yeah. Learning a little bit about the process. But let's start at the beginning. Almost every person we've had on this show, every entrepreneur we've had on this show, has some sort of origin story. They have a place where they began, really, a place where they began to learn that actually, hey, I could run this. I could be the man in charge. I could deal the woman. I could be the person in charge here. And sometimes there's a struggle. Sometimes there's a conflict. Do you have a point in your past that you can tell us about, which kind of demonstrates your transition from employee to entrepreneur?
You know, one thing that I've struggled with since a young age, I grew up in I'm not the only, there's what, seven of us siblings, half of us have masters. My second oldest brother has a PhD. My youngest sister is getting her MD, halfway through my PhD. And believe it or not, I think, say you argue between my oldest brother and me, were the least academic of the group. And a lot of that comes from the fact that I struggled with pretty significant learning disabilities. Not quite dyslexia, but similar dyslexia, where I can read something totally normally, but in my head, I might read it as something completely different. So a lot of times I'll, write a sentence, I'll think it's completely literate, and it's not. It's gobbledygook. But when I read it, it looks perfect. So I actually have a few bottles of wine that are floating around in the universe. And it's one of my best selling wines. It is a egregious spelling error right on the front label. And I just live with it. It's just part of who I am. And it's something I wish I couldn't do, but and kind of going with that, I realized the world was going to always be a struggle in a different way. And it wasn't going to always meet me where I wanted to be. And so I had to kind of figure out ways of doing things that work for me, such that I could continue to excel and, find success. Because the normal 9 to 5, trying to get in and, you know, go to meetings and, you know, sit around a meeting where every piece of information they tell me is going to just come in one ear and go out the other and be ineffective was not going to work for me. And I wasn't going to thrive in those environments. So I had to create my own environment. And the reality is, I don't know if I really wanted to be an entrepreneur. I think I just kind of had to by necessity, because there just wasn't a place that I thrived in a setting where I could use all my capacity and use it in the right way to create change. So
do you remember any of your early projects where you were going at it alone and doing it your way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's kind of stumbled upon. I mean, a funny thing, you know, I started in the lead generation space in marketing in the affiliate world. And, you know, I spent months building out a beautiful lead generation website. And I was like, oh, this is going to beat all the big boys' asses. It's so fancy. It calculates a rate as you're going through the flow. And, you know, the first time I set it live, like I got this huge mega, you know, lead come through, like the lead gen guy, the guy that saw, you know, buying the data for me was just like, wow, I can't believe that came through. That was huge. And like, you know, I used that money to throw at it and nothing else came through. And I was like, what the hell happened? And I realized it was just too fancy. And I had to like, just dumb it down and make it more approachable, you know? And I realized that the target consumer wasn't always going to be that individual that can't just happen to find that website that one day, you know? And because most people I find that are in the high net worth individuals aren't going through lead gen forms online to refinance or purchase a mortgage. They're going through their buddy who's a banker, who knows somebody who's a banker, or they're going through whoever they're currently investing with. Especially as an, you know, entrepreneur, you know, if you pay yourself $10.99, you're going to have to work with someone who's holding your money because no one else is going to trust that you're making money. They're like, oh, you don't have a W-2 in America. So good luck trying to get a mortgage if you don't have a W-2, you know, which is just our version of being an employee. So America's banks, they only want to pay employees. They don't want to pay entrepreneurs. It's just kind of funny. You know, you can get a business loan, but you can't get a home loan. So
it's a similar thing here in the UK. You work with your accountants and tax advisors as much as possible to like reduce what you're earning on paper, right? So you don't have to pay huge amounts of tax. And that's amazing right up until the point where you want to get a mortgage or something. And then they're like, hey, you didn't earn very much. And you're like, no, you know, I did. I just, you know, it's over here, right? This little thing. And so, I totally understand that. That translates really well. So you started in the lead gen space and your early lesson was actually, there's no need to overcomplicate. And actually a lot of people are a lot simpler or they just want it like served to them. What did that transition into? Like, did you continue in the sort of lead gen space or at what point did that begin to change?
You know, I dabbled in e-commerce for a bit and it was just kind of that same thing again. You know, it was just about approachability, you know, and I started working with some of the As Seen on TV guys. I went to, you know, actually kind of what I think is one of the best trade shows in the e-commerce space that maybe two or three other people know of. And it's just so funny because like, you know, I go to the show and there'd be lawyers. I'll give it up now that I don't care anymore. Now that it's not my favorite little, you know, tool for finding employers or sorry, calling like people to hire me for as consulting. But is the, oh my goodness, I'm spacing on the name of it, but it happens. It's a Chicago houseware show.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it's, I mean, like, you know, you're sitting there you know, I was sitting there chatting. I mean, I just, you know, see like, oh, that was on Shark Tank. That's Laura Grenier. You know, that's, you know, Mr. Wonderful. And I'm like, oh, wow, they're just right there. And I, you know, went up and talked to Laura Grenier and, you know, she's like, you know, you should help me with this brand. Like, I really want help on this brand. We can see this one going. Like, and so we got connected and like ended up actually sitting next to the guy on the airplane back to Las Vegas because he was heading to another trade show in Las Vegas. So kind of, I forgot what the original question was, but simplifying things. Yeah. And that's like those asking on TV guys are really good at that, you know, but what was funny for them is they're really good doing on TV. They weren't the best at doing online. And we were kind of meeting in the middle and just kind of creating an ever flow kind of environment to just kind of transition between the two of them without, you know, creating any hiccups, you know, so.
That's phenomenal. And that's such a great space actually. And it's often the way you find yourself in a place where like those trade shows, you know, predominantly are brands looking to, you know, get exposure and find people to be a part of their brand and maybe buy them, invest in them, or, you know, it's something. But so often those spaces are also great spaces. Like you said, like actually you go in there as a consultant, speak to enough people, give enough advice, understand their challenges and offer them some advice. It could well be an amazing hunting ground for consultants that you know can help these kind of up and coming brands. So that's phenomenal. So you dabbled a little bit in e-commerce. You did your lead gen. You dabbled a little bit into e-commerce. At what point did your story begin to change and begin to gravitate towards wine?
Well, it's kind of funny. So my daughter was born in January of 2019.
I saw it on your social.
Yeah.
Stalking, I told you.
Yeah. And I started my PhD just a few months earlier in September of 2018. And in the PhD program, I was really starting to struggle with kind of what I was doing. And I didn't really enjoy marketing the same way anymore. And I was just, because I think when I was a young kid, I always knew I wanted to create something and I wanted to be a creator. And, you know, it was fun making websites and building technology, but I'm a huge kinesthetic learner. I learn through touch and experience. And there's only so much you can touch online, you know, and there wasn't, yeah, end of the day, you can build a beautiful website, you can create a beautiful, you know, ad campaign, you can, you know, create a beautiful video content, but still not a consumable or a, you know, hard object that you can hold in your hand. And you know, once I got to hold my daughter for the first time, I was just like, man, this is like such an incredible experience. Like, you know, my wife made it, you know, I did the easy part of that. But it was just such a beautiful and amazing thing. And I was just like, you know, I want to produce something. I want to be a part of something that I can be passionate about. And someone in my PhD cohort was a winemaker. And I was just like, oh my God, like, what are you doing in your PhD program? You must be a billionaire, because I had this belief that you had to be like a billionaire to be able to make wine. And, you know, and she goes, no, this is like, here's, she gave me the keys to the, you know, to the kingdom, and really kind of gave me my first, you know, show me the wine business trading website, you know, and where you can find and buy grapes and where you can find resources for producers or, you know, production facilities. You know, we work out of a co-op. So it was that. And then ironically, I read a book, which is very cheesy, but I think is brilliant, called Finding Your True North. I don't know if you've ever read it, but mm-hmm. It's a Harvard Business Review book. It's written by, he's a Harvard guy. But it's funny, in there, he kind of just talks about like, you know, you can thrive, you know, and a lot of these guys were like high thriving individuals. And until they really pivoted and sunk in their teeth into what they really wanted to be doing, did they start seeing their growth and get to the point that they wanted to be. And he pointed out to Kirkpatrick, who is the second CEO of Charles Schwab, third CEO, and a couple other individuals. And it resonated with me because my dad was actually worked with Kirkpatrick at Charles Schwab. So I knew it. And a lot of the stories they were telling were like, oh yeah, that's about my dad. So it's kind of funny to hear that going through, but yeah. Anyways, so that's kind of how I started. Yeah.
So you met this lady. She gave you the keys to the kingdom in terms of like pointing you in the right direction about the wine industry. What was it about the wine industry that that drew you in? And what was the thing that was broken in the wine industry that you'd spotted that you felt like you could get involved and improve?
Yeah. So that goes back to, you know, when I was in high school and college surfing in Northern California in Half Moon Bay. And, you know, I got sick one time surfing, and it was just like, how'd I end up with like a bacterial infection in the water? I've had multiple at this point. I've had like staph. I've had almost gangrene, not quite, but my leg started to turn green anyways, it's a long, disgusting story. Wow. that no one wants to hear about. but the water is just disgusting and it's sad. And I was, you know, trying to figure out like, well, why is this, you know, place in Half Moon Bay? There's, you know, it's a town of 5,000 people. There's, you know, no trash on the road. It's not halfly as dirty. And the irony is it's called Venice Beach, is the beach that was super dirty. And you'd think of Venice Beach, LA when I first read it. And I was like, oh, that makes sense. And then I realized, no, it's Venice Beach, Half Moon Bay. There's like a little, and I was like, that's where I surf. Like, what the hell? And the dirtiness came from the farm runoff and, you know, all the farming and the nearby agriculture. And I was thinking, man, that's pretty horrendous that agriculture can cause, you know, something that we're eating and consuming can cause so much destruction to the ocean and to the environment. And so that's where I was just like, well, this is clearly a product that I love to consume. And I hate the fact that I'm consuming a product that potentially has a negative impact on the planet. You know, now that I have a child, I would like it to be here at least for as long as I live, you know, for her and for the generations to come after that, because it's an amazing place to be, you know. So that's how I ended up in wine. I was like, this is something I consume regularly. I spend time, and now I spend a stupid amount of money making it. Before I spent a stupid amount of money buying it. Now I'm making my own, you know. But so, yes, that's how I transitioned. That's how I picked wine.
So. That's incredible. So you were surfing in a glorious bay in beautiful waters, surfing. There's nothing around that would suggest any kind of contaminants or anything like that. And yet when you did, you dug into it, it turns out it was the runoff from the nearby farms running into the water, and that water, somehow that's allowed. For whatever reason, and that is going into the water and then causing all kinds of problems that you experienced firsthand. Wow. And yeah, that's incredible. So you're like, wow, okay, so I like wine. Clearly there's a problem with farming as a whole sector, but farming wine as well. I'm going to do this differently, and I'm going to somehow do this. I'm going to create a great tasting product by doing it differently to the majority of people in the industry, and create something that people want to buy that's also affordable. That seems like a hell of a Hail Mary. How did you approach that? Like, obviously you've achieved that. We know kind of not the end of the story, but like further down the story. But at this point, how did you even approach that?
Well, you know, you start with one challenge and task and then just kind of grow from there. And what's funny is there are a lot of times where I'll start with one process and belief, and I'll read a white paper, you know, written by academics at UC Davis to explain why such and such a process is better for the planet. And then 6 months that changes and the belief on that is wrong. And you realize like, and you start to like beat yourself up on it. You're like, wait, no, that's just what we believed at the time was the right thing to do. So, you know, I say with working with, you know, try to be better and cleaner and, you know, more environmentally friendly, it's not a job that ever stops. And I think that that's something that I just have come to terms with and I've approached with. You know, I mean, believe it or not, 49% of CO2 emissions from winemaking come from the packaging alone. And that's because of glass, you know, and glass bottles are hard to ship. They're, you know, they break the amount of energy and carbon that goes into producing each bottle, recycling each bottle, transporting each bottle. And in fact, most wine bottles don't get recycled because most places in the United States actually aren't equipped to recycle wine bottles. So people throw in their bin and then end up getting thrown to the bin, the dumpster anyways, once they get to the recycling facility. So it's just kind of an ongoing challenge that I look at. And to me, I think that's what makes it fun. It's challenging and it sucks. Like, I wish I had the answer to be just perfect all the time. But it's something that it's like you have to look at and reapproach every day. And just kind of, and I just spend all my, you know, spare time, you know, researching and reading and learning about how do we make our process more carbon friendly, water friendly, you know, resource friendly. And then also, you know, at the end of the day, when you do all those things, it ends up being more human friendly. So if you start from the top, you know, the bottom up, you know, from where it grows to where it finishes, you're going to end up with a better product at the end of the day. So, you know, it's a lot of people can try to fix things in the top layer, but the ultimate, you're going to always have a shaky base. So, you know, I always say start with farming. So that's where it goes.
I love that. And I appreciate the challenge as well, because, like, you know, take our products here at Newbrew, right? We switch to eco-friendly packaging. So it's paper and cardboard predominantly, which can then be recycled. It's biodegradable and so on. But, you know, we're selling powder, right? We're selling powdered supplements, in effect. Whereas in the wine space, I can see, and recently we had Ivo on, the founder of a vodka brand. It would be the same for him. Like, these industries, it would be a different experience if a waiter came to your table to pour you a glass of wine and it came out of a carton, right? Like a cardboard carton. Yeah. It would be a very different experience, and it shouldn't be, because the wine inside could be exactly the same, right? As long as that's been manufactured in a way that's not contaminants, and it doesn't sort of mess with the wine and so forth. But yeah, it would take the sheen and the whatever off of the experience if they're pouring it out of a carton, and then you don't want plastic. That goes against the, you know, that's makes things worse. That's surely worse than glass. So that is a packaging of these kind of drinks. That's a tough one just right at the beginning. But in terms of the farm, so I mean, how did you already have a vineyard, or like how did you even approach that?
Yeah, so kind of like I said, my cohort, she's actually a professor now. She finished her PhD on time because she was doing things, you know, not trying to start a winery. She already had an established winery when she started her program. Connect me with a website where you can basically find, like, it's like Craigslist for winemakers. So you can find, you know, a lot of people don't realize this, but most wineries in California buy grapes from farmers. And most farmers, by the time they're done harvesting and making, you know, growing their grapes and tending to their vineyards, they don't want anything to do with it. If you go all the way through, it's just a lot of work to do it, you know. So, you know, you start, it's, as soon as we finish harvest, the farmers get like a month off, and then, you know, come, you know, December, January, those guys are pruning, and then, you know, bud break happens around now. Bud break's when, you know, the first little things start showing. And then once bud break happened, man, those guys are like 24/7 there until those grapes come off the vine, anywhere between August and November. So this website basically gave me a list of places and wineries, and then from there started the interview process, you know, and a lot of it you can kind of find from wines that you can taste and finding, you know, and a big thing that happens, I mean, I'm part of the, you know, California National Wine Community. There's a lot of winemakers like us who are doing a lot of the same things. So part of it happens like, oh man, dude, that guy's wine's great. And so I'll call up that farmer, like, hey, do you have any more of those grapes? And he'll be like, no, I don't. And then, you know, you'll talk to them about his process. I'm like, can I check out your vineyard? And, you know, two things I do that's sneaky is, one, I snoop everywhere, because, you know, I'm looking for Roundup. I'm looking for glyphosate. There's those terrible salts that just are there to kill weeds, and they stick around forever. They don't go away. Like, once you use them, they're stuck. You know, you can't get rid of them, and they just are terrible for the water table. So I'll snoop around, and their guys declared they're organic. You're not supposed to use that. And I found them in their back sheds, and I was like, well, we're not. And I was dead set on buying grapes from these guys. They're one of the most expensive grape producers in, you know, a certain region. I'm not going to point any fingers. I was like, yeah, I'm definitely not buying grapes from you. And then the last thing I do is I go talk to the laborers, you know, and I find a field crew guy, and I just say, hey, what's up, man? How's your, you know, how do these guys treat you? Are you happy here? You know, and, you know, I use my elementary Spanish that I somehow managed to hold on to. I wish it was better. I still work on it every day. But so that's kind of my three-step process is, you know, find something I like, talk to the farmer, and then snoop.
Beautiful. So. I love that. And it's so important to go that extra mile, because, yeah, like what you said, like digging just a little bit below the surface, and you begin to uncover things which actually are different to what they say they are. So you've now got this wine, and Hollow Wines, forgive me if I'm misunderstanding, but Hollow Wines is what's known as a natural wine, which is different to most of the wines that exist on the planet that you pick up from the supermarket. Why is it different? What is a natural wine, and why should everybody switch to it?
That's the billion-dollar question in the wine industry right now, because it's been a little bit space disruptive. there are guidelines for producing natural wine in France and Italy, and maybe Austria and Germany. I can't remember if they are or not. I mean, I'm familiar with the French laws, and the French laws are just coming into place. The Italian laws have been there for a long time. But there's no rules. Any joker, and there are a few that do claim their wines are natural and are nowhere near natural. I say I'm natural because that's kind of the label that's been prescribed to what I'm trying to do. But I prefer the label Earth First Winemaking, where we really focus on, you know, because the reality of natural winemaking is you buy grapes from an organic producer that are handpicked, that are thrown into a barrel, you know, and are pressed and stomped, and nothing ever touches them. You never add any sulfur, never add anything. And there's, you know, sulfur's gotten this really bad rap in the natural wine, you know, kind of from a consumer perspective. None of the producers actually hate sulfur. But the consumers associate it with headaches, which is actually kind of the opposite. Sulfur actually can prevent headaches from happening in wine when used in the right amounts. There's so much debate, and it's something that I get asked a lot, and there's no right answer. So for me, I hold on to the label only because if I said Earth First Winemaking, I would lose half of my customer base because they don't understand. And this is just what they understand. I grab them with my first thing, you know, the fact that I am natural. I do follow the vin natura practices, which are the Italian practice. I'm hardcore about it to a fault. But at the same time too, I want to change that perspective in the end and start to realize, hey, like there are, you know, there's like 90 approved additives in wine, and you go to a grocery store, there's things that are just like, you know, a lot of grocery store wines aren't vegan, you know, and I have a vegan sister. I'm on and off again, vegetarian. You look at that and you're like, why can a wine be not vegetarian, let alone vegan? Right. And they're using egg whites, fish guts, isinglass, which is fish scales. And it's just, or fish bladders, excuse me, beef livers, like cow hoofs, like all kinds of crazy stuff. And then, you know, those things are actually, you know, can be organic, believe it or not, you know, cause they're, you know, they're coming into something like that. Right. But the more gross stuff is the chemicals that they're dumping in there, you know, that are, you know, pulled out of petroleum refining and terrible, toxic things. And these are all the wine, you know, 99% of the wines on a grocery store shelf you walk into, you know, in America, and probably, you know, United Kingdom too. Maybe not as bad in the United Kingdom because EU, well, you guys have new laws now, but EU has some pretty stricter laws than we do. Mm-hmm. So that's why my consumer is concerned. I want them to be in the middle. I want them to realize, okay, there are some organic additives that could be potentially good that we're looking at, we're exploring. We haven't committed to any yet, but we're looking at, and my friends in the natural wine community, we discuss all the time. We'd love to move away from something from sulfur, because sulfur is not the best product per se. It's the only product right now, but I believe there might be an organic product out there we haven't experienced. That's a very long way to answer.
So people not in the know go into it thinking wine, one ingredient, grapes. Yeah. Not the case. But yeah. Then there's ingredients when you delve into it and scratch beneath the surface, there's ingredients which are organic. So you're like, organic, that's amazing. But it could be an organic cow's guts or an organic fish's scales. So right. It's definitely not vegetarian or vegan. And you're like, okay, so maybe organic's not so good. And then you dig deeper and then you're finding, in the really bad brands, you're finding like just flat out chemicals and things that will definitely give you a headache, that they're there for whatever purpose. And so going with the title natural over say organic, allows for the good additives that might not necessarily be organic, but also pushes away anything which isn't natural, like flat out chemicals. Is that somewhere around the mark?
Exactly.
Nice. Yeah. It sounds amazing. And it's crazy. I remember growing up, So the story I tell, I remember sort of like going out, you know, going out drinking as you do when you're younger and you're socializing with your friends and so on. And there's an expression that nothing good happens after 2 a.m., right? Yeah. That's the expression. And I remember that, you know, once you're in the flow of it and say the clubs and the pubs and stuff are closing, you end up going to those late night bars, the kind of bars where they're like, we'll give you 5 shots for like $5 or something, right? You know, and it's atrociously cheap, but you're like, wow, that sounds amazing. All right, I'm going to get into that. And I remember sort of looking back at it one day, feeling a little bit worse for wear, and thinking, hang on, when I finish drinking at midnight, or even like finish drinking at midnight, but go on to a friend's house and just, you know, socialize there, the difference in the headache the next day compared to the nights where you go on to those bars where they're giving you, you know, 5 shots for $5 or something is night and day. The headaches are so much worse when you go to those late night things. And I did some digging and I realized that, or what I learned was that actually in the spirit space, in the spirit liquor space, so your vodkas, your whiskies, your whatever, you have to spend over a certain amount, because actually you assume, like, for example, vodka has been made with wheat or barley or potatoes or something like that, but actually under a certain price point it's just chemicals. It's just like all chemicals. It's been made and there hasn't really touched any kind of you know, vegetable at any point, right? And it's just been made in a laboratory, and as such those additives, those chemicals, that's what messes with the system and gives you a headache as your body's trying to flush them out. And I can see how that relates to the wine space and why people would want to avoid that, and how it's easy to get sucked into the labeling and the branding of these other brands with larger budgets. So if people want to learn more about Hollow Wines, get in touch with you, buy themselves several bottles or a case, how can they do so?
Believe it or not, it's the devil in disguise. I've been forced to embrace Instagram, and it's just the number way. I respond to my Instagram messages probably faster than I do my text messages and phone calls. Because it's just the online community that's, the natural wine community is very strong on there. My followers are strong on there. My customers are strong on there. And, you know, I don't even post anymore, like for the most part, but I share all the beautiful things that my, you know, consumers post. And I really love to kind of, you know, add them to my, you know, my stories and so forth. And every time I do that, because it's just cool. It's like, you know, I think wine's about sharing. You know, you go back to the old, you know, Greek symposium days, and, you know, people get around in circles and share and drink wine. And, you know, honestly, I have all these like fancy, expensive bottles of wine that I've collected over the years. And like, I'll rarely crack open an expensive bottle. You know, like if I'm by myself, like I really set a limit at like $25. You know, it's like I don't want to open anything more than that, because anything more than that has so much more going on, so much more story, so much more, you know. And again, you can always, there's tricky thing with price. A lot of times, you know, kind of like the iPhones and these cell phones now, where the cost of the good is like, you know, 70% marketing, 10% manufacturing. And, you know, being in marketing, you know how that works. You know, again, it's about sharing. So that's the best way to get a hold of me is Instagram.
Instagram. So are they searching Hollow Wines, or are they searching Quinn Hobbs?
Just at Hollow Wine.
Hollow Wine?
Yeah.
Super easy. There you go, folks. And yeah, HollowWines.com.
Hollow Wines, and then I lost the login, and you know how that goes. And luckily, I hadn't really thrived on it yet and started on it yet. So I was like, well, Hollow Wine's available, so we're just going to go with Hollow Wine.
So. Beautiful. So check them out on Instagram and hollowwines.com for the website. So Quinn, at this point in the interview, I like to mix it up. We go into the rapid fire question round. I ask the questions quickly. You can choose the speed in which you reply. Are you up for that?
Let's do it.
Yeah. Two thumbs up. Up for that?
I'm ready. Two thumbs.
There you are. There they are. Let's jump in. If you ever had to start again, how would you make your money?
Oof. You know, it's kind of funny. So the day before I got into a bunch of great universities. I was told I wasn't going to any universities because my GPA didn't reflect one thing I was good at was standardized testing. So they're like, my college counselor's like, you're not getting anywhere you want to go to. The day I started, the day before I had to make a decision, I just couldn't decide. And my college counselor got permission from the school and said, hey, he's going to drive down to San Luis Obispo and check out Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, which now has, you know, one of the top 3 enology programs in the state. And, there was a, and then I ended up going to Santa Clara, but I drove all the way down there, toured around. The problem is I only gave myself a few hours to really check out the school, and I didn't give myself enough time to check out the area, because had I checked out the area, I would easily check, you know. It's funny, cause I grew up going to the area, but I just wasn't ready to, I guess I wasn't ready to leave home. But if I'd really pushed myself a little bit to leave home, I had a great job. I was working at a bicycle store. I was doing very, very well for a high school kid selling bicycles. So I just wasn't ready to leave that life. But I wish I'd pushed myself out of my comfort zone a little earlier and gone to Cal Poly. I might have been a winemaker at 23. So
you'd have done the early journey a little bit different and got straight into winemaking a lot earlier on than what you did.
No regrets though, man. I'm very happy with my life. So amazing. That's the only thing I may have. I sometimes wonder, I'm like, man, I was almost there from the beginning, but it took me an extra, you know, 12 years or, you know, however many years. So
nice. Question two, what's the most common or biggest mistake leaders make?
I think there's the fine line between pivoting and standing your ground. I think there's a lot of times I think leaders see things changing and quickly change because they're afraid they're going to miss out on a bandwagon. And that's kind of how I was with online marketing and e-commerce, is I was always chasing the next high and the next big thing, the next big product. But a lot of things come full circle. And, you know, I learned with wine quickly that I went from online space, which is like get things done overnight, to just, you have to wait, man. Wine doesn't make itself overnight. It's a, you know, the fastest wine we have from vine to bottle is pretty astounding. It's like about, I think, 2.5 months all said and done, which is crazy. Most people are, you know, a year, vine to bottle. Well, average is probably 9 months, average is probably a year. So it's a space where you just have to be patient. So I think it's learning that fine line of pivoting and standing your ground. And I think the biggest mistake leaders make is they pivot too fast and they're always chasing the next high, as opposed to just remembering that there needs to be some patience and just do what you do well and just keep doing what you do well, because that's how you master. So
I love that. That's incredibly insightful. Who is a great leader, whether alive or dead, and why?
It's kind of a wine nerd reference. Steve Mathiasen is a guy that I look wholeheartedly up to. And the dude is doing it right since day one. Another one would be Ron Saletto. He passed away last year. He's the first farmer I got connected with. And I buy a lot from his son, John, who's also an amazing man. But Ron, there wasn't a man in his vineyard that didn't have a great life. His foreman lives on his property. His son and I joke that his foreman drives a nicer car than us. You know, and he's the only one actually making money in the business. You know, I think is a guy like Ron is, you know, he's there with his workers every day. The guy was a huge, big hotshot CEO for one of the largest wine companies when he retired back in the early 90s, and then decided to buy vineyards instead. So I think it's just being humble and being a person that, you know, the type of guy Steve Mathiasen and Ron Saletto are people that, you know, outside CEOs and big shots and, you know, those guys, you know, they show up to Napa wineries. They expect to talk to the big hotshot winemaker. And most of the time those winemakers actually aren't making wine. Mm. It's, some other young kid straight out of grad school or, a guy that was originally a laborer from Mexico or Central America that came up and has been doing it for 30 years and gets no credit. And I think the amazing part about Ron and Steve is they don't ever let those guys walk away with no credit. And they make sure that they're the most important people. And when those guys walk into the room, they want to talk to them, not the billionaire CEOs. So that's why I admire those two people for that reason.
I love that. So on a similar note, how do you hire top talent, like those talented foremen?
So we're still technically a one-man band, but we're looking to hire this year. And I found two incredible individuals by accident. I found a really great employment agency in the Central Coast that basically manages a lot of vineyard work, and they're not cheap. A lot of people are like, oh, you can pay a lot less. And I'm like, I feel good about paying these guys because they get paid a living wage. And then on top of it, they're getting health insurance and all these benefits. So I feel good about it. And I stumble up, and when I found that, I feel like when you have everybody completed and their benefits are there, and people are given what they deserve and earn, you know, or should earn, they give twice as much. So sometimes I feel like you just have to find the right people. And then when you're willing to give to them, they give back twice as much. So it's, I don't know if it's finding the type talent. I don't know if that's the right way of finding it, but I think a lot of time people are always trying to find like, how do I get it cheaper? How do I get it this? You know, it's with talent, I think that's the last place you want to go cheaper. So, beautiful. Yeah.
What is one of your proudest moments?
I mean, you know, I would be remiss if I didn't say, you know, marrying my wife or having my kid, but those really weren't things that I necessarily did, you know? But I feel like I have a proud moment every day, you know, when I teach my kids something and she learns a new word, you know, or now she's older. She's learning plenty of words now, but now we're, you know, teach her how to do something and she figures it out, like making cupcakes and stuff like that. So I think it's just when I teach someone and they learn and you see that happen. So I don't know if I have like a specific moment in general, but it just any time where you like, you know, I think the joke in my family was, I always loved to play cards when I was a kid. And, annoying part is I would learn a new card game and I would get really good at it. And then I would teach my siblings and they'd all beat me. And I get really frustrated and they're like, stop being such a good teacher is what they say.
Yeah. None of the expression's cat tiger, isn't it? When the teacher deliberately doesn't let the tiger teacher will only teach their students to be a cat, not a tiger, so that they're always like a better, but like actually proper teachers. You're like, you know, my goal is to teach you so that you become better at this than I am. Yeah. So that's amazing. Yeah, that you're not a cat tiger teacher.
I like that. I'm going to use that. I mean, thank you. Steal that from you.
What's one interesting fact about you that not many people would know?
Oh, I don't know. I guess self-taught winemaker, I guess. A lot of people were like, where do you learn this stuff? And I self-taught in the sense I went and worked a harvest for free in Australia. So I think that's one thing that I've always been willing to do. Is to work for free, because when you work for free, you learn the most because you realize that you have to find a way to get your ROI in the end somewhere else. Because if you're working for pay, oftentimes you just collect paychecks, you know, and you're not there to try to grow. But if you're working for free, you can learn a lot. And I continue to work for free. It's crazy. I got to stop a little. I got to do a little less maybe, but you know.
But yeah. I mean, I would add that. I would add to that and say that if you're working for free, but you're transparent with whoever you're working for free and said to them, hey, I'm doing this to learn. Yes, and, absolutely. You know, I'm working for free in return. You're paying me with teaching. So then if you do that, then you can leverage at any point where you don't feel like you're being exposed to new things to learn from. You can be like, hey, just a reminder, I am doing this for free. So, you know, but my learning seems to have slowed down a little bit. Could you, buck up? I think that's, you know, there's a leverage tool as well, right? Like when you're doing that, you can be transparent with it.
That's smart. And they're willing to give. People are willing to give. Like when people, you know, I've had people do the same for me and I give so much more because I want them to get the ROI. I feel guilty. I don't want people to work for me for free.
Yeah.
Some people in wine have already come and they'll come help out and I sit there and I, you know, I'm like, let me know if I'm doing too much. Like, no, give me too much. And I'm like, okay.
What daily routines do you have, whether morning or evening, that have helped make you successful?
You know, I think it's funny. I'm kind of skirting on my duties now, but as soon as we get done with this, I take my dog to the dog park because, you know, I'm an at-home solo worker. It gives me a chance to talk to other people and learn. And I think, you know, you can get sucked into when I first started being a solopreneur 8 years ago, I was between girlfriends. I, you know, my parents had kind of took my dog. They were happier with my parents still living in apartments, and I lived on a ranch in post college. So I think it's just kind of getting out there and getting your finger on the pulse, and just talking to anybody that agrees with you, doesn't agree with you. You know, there's this, you know, like everywhere in America, there's a political divide. There's a political divide at the dog park. And not necessarily just talking to people of the same opinions as you, is going and talking to people of different opinions as you. And you learn so much more when you push yourself to learn from someone that you might not agree with. So I think that's something that I start with the day, and just kind of, that's kind of my kickoff, is I go find the most controversial people I'm really argue with, and we go have a good little morning argue. And that gets me fired up, and the wheels are turning after that point. So.
Nice. Well, I mean, if they're passionate enough about a subject to argue, they've probably got some pretty good insights to share, right? So actually, yeah, like you said, that's a fine opportunity to learn. If emotion's removed from there, you can learn away and figure out why they think whatever stupid thing is legit. And who knows, you might go, wow, they've actually got some solid points there. Where there's passion, I always say that there's no such thing as a boring conversation or a boring person. And if you're finding a conversation boring, then you, as the, if you like, interviewer, are failing to find what that person's passionate about, because when someone's speaking about their passion, they can't be boring. Like, whatever it is, it could be like the finer details of creating a screw that really goes into wood and attaches wood together well. You know, it could be something like as mundane as that, but if there's someone who's super passionate about it and can talk to you about that, it won't be boring, it'll be interesting. So there's often a lot of passion when it comes to like arguing and high emotion stuff. So it's a twofer. What daily not daily routines, we asked that one. What book or books changed your mindset or life?
Ooh. I mean, I guess I mentioned it before, Find Your True North. You know, again, it's cheesy Harvard Business Review material. Everybody's read HBR stuff. They've gone to MBA programs, but it's important, you know, and I've recommended it to other serial solo entrepreneurs and, you know, or entrepreneurs who have big companies. And once they get through the cheesy part of it, they get grounded, and it helps them kind of dial in their process, I think.
So, nice. What advice would you give your younger self?
Be so comfortable. You know, I think, you know, there's always that point of complacency when you find something that works and you just keep doing it because it works and you don't grow, you know? And I think that there have been points where I've been nervous or scared or afraid, you know, to take on a new challenge or live somewhere else. I've really never lived outside of California. And I'm married an Australian, and 2024 we'll be hitting the ship across the Pacific. Because I made a promise that my kid would go to, you know, school in Australia. So
nice.
So it'll be my first time living abroad. We'll hopefully be all right. But it's kind of crazy to say that, you know, as an international person like myself, that it only happened at, you know, I'll be 37 when that happens. So
same language said in a completely different way. Right. But one insight I would give you is there's not a lot of tipping that goes on in Australia. So you've got to save yourself a ton of money. There.
It's in Sydney, they're tipping more because it's such, they're kind of mimicking. I hate to say this because some Australians are going to slap me in the face.
Mimicking the US.
They copy LA. It's like LA, Sydney is like LA meets Miami, you know? Yeah. But
yeah, so Hollow Wines is the Instagram handle if you want to disagree with that point to Quinn. Yeah. That's where you want to message. No, I totally get what you're saying. And I mean, the world is becoming quite like, I don't know if homogenized is the right word, but like, you know, it's becoming blended. Like there's blur lines, the things which are great in one culture, by definition, right? If like people who are the same, they just speak a different language, different place. You know, they might be like, hey, that's quite a good way of doing things. Let's adopt that. So that's why. What unusual or underrated food or drink, not wine, should more people try out?
Ooh, my new thing is tepache. I'm probably saying it wrong. I don't know if you've had this before, but it's fermented. They take the rinds from pineapple and they boil them and then they ferment them naturally and they get a little alcoholic, get some probiotics and yeast cultures in there. So it's kind of like a kombucha, but made from pineapple.
I was going to say, it sounds a little bit like kombucha, but that's the main point of difference. It comes from pineapple rather than
pineapple husks. So, you know, I'm a big believer of using things that are waste. So I actually make a raspberry, grape hybrid wine where I blend the two. They're actually co-fermented together, and I have a blackberry, wine that I've made with the pressing. So our rosé, we press right away. We get the grapes and press them right away. That's how you get rosé. Leave it on skin for just a certain amount of time to get the color. Cause a lot of people don't realize this. There's only three grapes in the world that produce red juice and none of them are ones that people are familiar with. Probably the most common one is Alicante Boucher. The rest, you take a Cabernet grape, you squeeze it, it's clear. So it gets the color from the skin. So, so we take the pressings from that, we put on top of blackberries and, boom, it's like we ferment that and it becomes a magical product. So I love things that are made with things that would be normally thrown away. And the blackberries and raspberries I get are from these big blackberry and berry farms where as they're sorting, if there's any, when they berries get overripe, sometimes they'll burst and they have to throw those away. And so, but they're fine for fermenting. You just can't keep them on a grocery store shelf because they'll mold and get dirty. So I pick them up same day, throw them into the fermenter and ferment them. So tapache is something to be wasted. It turns into something beautiful. So I love things that are waste that turn into beautiful things. So
there's so many opportunities like that. There's two opportunities I can think of. One is like wonky fruit. So there's a thing called wonky fruit, which is like the fruit and vegetables that aren't pretty enough for the supermarket shelves, right? And I love the supermarkets in Cyprus, for example, Greek island. It's an island near Greece. And they don't have the whole, like, you know, vegetables need to be pretty. And so you've got these sort of peppers and, you know, cucumbers and carrots and stuff, which kind of all look like weird organs. They're odd compared to what you see in the sort of high, you know, polished beauty pageant world of supermarket vegetable shelves. And you know, they taste just as great, if not better. And there's a lot of companies that are like buying up wonky fruit and veg to do things with those. There's other companies that are like getting like used coffee grounds from the coffee shops, where it's an annoyance. It's a waste product of these coffee shops, and they're turning them into fuel, or they're turning them into compost, or, you know, they're reusing these things. And I think that's a wonderful way of looking at it, because actually a lot of the time someone else's you know, waste and annoyance is actually like a gold mine for your business if you can do it in the right way. So capace from pineapple. Final question then, what makes you happiest?
It's when my daily routine works out. You know, get my dog park in, take my kid to school, get a good surf in, and then, you know, make some kick-ass wine, and then get to spend the evening with my daughter and wife. Just a really, like, when the stars align and I'm able to do all those things, it's just makes me happy. You know, because I love to work and I love to surf and I love to hang out with my family. So when I can do all three, it's great.
Yeah. Great day. I love that. And that's such a simple, answer, but keeping it simple, it's actually way easier to achieve. It's just those things that you like, if you can fit them all in a day, you just know that it's all going to align and you're going to have a kick-ass day as a result. That's an amazing answer to top off an amazing question and answer round. Quinn, that brings us pretty much to the end of the show. At this point, I'd just like to ask, do you have any asks or requests of the audience listening today?
No, I mean, but definitely, I think, you know, one thing I'd ask consumers and challenge themselves to do, we're going back, I can't remember if this happened in the interview before when we're talking about packaging. And, you know, a lot of people get sold on buying wine because it's a fancy bottle and so forth and all these things. And I'd say challenge yourself to spend more money on canned wine or bagged wine, because, you know, 49% of CO2 emissions come from, and the wine industry come from, the glass bottles and the glass packaging. And it costs more money to put wine into a can, and we make less money on it. We don't, you know, there's one wine that's going to be a loss leader just to get that I'm putting into can. But it's to get people excited to try my other canned wines, you know, and I think that, people need to, be comfortable spending $12 on a can of wine. It's a half a bottle. So $12 on a can of wine, people will easily spend $40 on a bottle. You should be happy with the exact half being $20. And the best part is you have less weight, right? If you're drinking by yourself, you should, you know, that's two glasses a night. That's the healthy recommendation for the, whatever the, you know, Food and Drug Administration recommends in America. So two glasses, one can, it's perfect amount. So
perfect amount. You don't have half a bottle of wine just sat in your fridge or on your side, not being used anymore.
Yeah.
So, brilliant. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Drink more wine. That's the arsehole request, but as long as
no, not too much though.
In moderation. Quinn, this has been an amazing interview. You're an enlightened entrepreneur for sure, and there's been so many little nuggets and learnings that other enlightened entrepreneurs in the audience can take, and budding enlightened entrepreneurs can learn from to make their business more future-proof, to, as you said, make sure that their business isn't harming the chance of a future generation and an amazing earth for our future generation to enjoy and benefit from, like we are right now. It's amazing. Check out hollowwines.com. Check out Hollow Wines on Instagram. And Quinn, thank you so much for taking the time to share with us today.
Thank you, Martin. Appreciate it, man. It's great.
Hey there, you incredibly good-looking human. Thanks so much for listening. If you had a good time today and would like more good times in the future, please hit that subscribe button and leave a heartwarming review. I read them all and it will go a long way to help others out there benefit from all the teachings of this show. And if you want to get in touch or otherwise learn more about me, head to martincook.co.uk or smarterdestiny.com. I really appreciate you. You're an incredible human. Until next time, keep crushing.